much. You know, with all the comedians that this group has produced, these are hard acts to follow here. But I do want to tell you that I'm very pleased to be with you today and to be here as your speaker. As Ken pointed out, I know most of you think of me as a marketing representative for Don Lipsett's Adam Smith Ties, but it's good to be here in this capacity to bring you greetings from President Reagan and to participate in this annual conference. I'm particularly pleased to be here at the occasion, which, as Ed Fulner announced, my good friend Glenn Campbell was one of those that was elected as a distinguished member of this organization. As I'll mention later on, I think we all owe a great deal to Glenn, among some of the others that you've honored and mentioned here, for maintaining the conservative heritage over a long period of time when that was not necessarily the popular thing to do in some of our areas of academia. But I do come here glad to get away from Washington. It's always a good idea to get away from Washington, but these have been particularly busy days in the last couple of weeks. As many of you know, it was just about 2 weeks ago that we had to tear ourselves away from such critical problems as the Middle East, Central America, the defense budget, the MX missile, and the other things that make the headlines to tackle one of the truly great problems that face Americans this year. Will the Beach Boys sing on the Mall on the 4th of July? Now, as some of you know, President Reagan is very keen on using his cabinet. And so when this question first hit, he convened a cabinet meeting and asked for help, advice, ideas, how could we handle this situation? Well, we found a lot of things about our cabinet that were somewhat new. For example, Cap Weinberger, despite the problems with the defense budget, was the first to offer some assistance. And he said that if Jim Watt didn't feel the Beach Boys was appropriate, that at least he could guarantee that he could produce the Marine Corps Drum and Bugle Corps. Actually, most people don't understand that the Pentagon is much more musically inclined than most folks think, and certainly more than the news media would have you believe. Right now, the top of their hit parade contains what some refer to as a golden oldie, which is entitled, I Found a Billion-Dollar Missile in a 5 and 10 cent Store. Dave Stockman, in his traditional approach to things, his frugality, thought that the best that the government could come up with for the 4th of July was a three-penny opera. But it remained to George Shultz to develop a new group that he thought would be most appropriate. He thought we ought to invite the Arab-Israeli military choir singing their new hit, I Wonder Where's Kissinger Now? In any event, I do welcome this opportunity to come, as Ken suggested, as one of the family, and to spend the next several minutes talking informally with you about the conservative movement, to look back at where we have been, to examine where we are now, and perhaps with you to explore where we might be going, particularly as we now have a new dimension, and that is the opportunity for action as well as what this society has been most famous for, the development of ideas and concepts and philosophical approaches. I would like to suggest that what we are really doing at the present time in Washington, throughout the country, is confronting a challenge where we have the opportunity to translate into public policy the ideas that have been reflected in the writings and in effect to make conservatism work. And I would suggest to you, and I hope you will not think it self-serving, that we have a leader in the White House who has demonstrated over the past quarter of a century a capacity to make the conservative principles and to take the conservative principles and translate them into effective governmental action. Looking back in time, we have, as we go back, the phrase from Richard Weaver when he talked about ideas having consequences, perhaps the counterpoint of that, and that is that there are also consequences from a lack of ideas. Indeed, I would suggest to you that in the 1930s and in the 1940s, left-leaning academicians dominated the intellectual scene and essentially unopposed, at least in a broader sense, by the ideas from conservative thinkers, they left behind a legacy that determined the political consensus in America for a generation. Milton Friedman has said it very well when he has indicated that the platform of the Socialist Party, within a quarter of a century, had been adopted almost point by point by both the Republican and the Democratic parties, simply because the American people and their political leaders had succumbed to the steady drumbeat of the academicians and the writers, the broadcasters, the members of the press, who had had a continual articulation of these ideas over such a long period of time. Dr. Kirk, your new president, is fond of quoting the saying that conservatives prefer to sit and think, or sometimes just to sit. Now, I recognize that this body is different in its composition, but certainly conservative thinkers were sitting out, essentially, the debate in the 1930s and the 1940s, so that by 1950, Lionel Trilling could write, as he did, in a comment that was perhaps more representative of public thinking than accurate, that liberalism was not only the dominant, but even the sole intellectual tradition in the United States. Now, obviously, we would say that this overstates the case. And one reason is that as conservatives, we do have a feeling for preserving that which has been derived from the past, the values and the philosophy that has endured the test of time, and that is an important thing to preserve for the future. But as Whitaker Chambers once observed, each generation renders its version of the truth in its own contemporary idiom. And so it is important that we not leave, as we have done sometimes in the past, allow the idiom of an age to be left to those who oppose us almost without opposition. I say almost because it is true that by the late 1940s, von Hayek and Weaver were being read, and by 1953, a great contribution to the growing body of conservative thought was provided by Dr. Kirk's book, The Conservative Mind. As a matter of fact, I remember, and I'm sure Jeff Hart does too, that about that same time, the academic community was startled by an imaginative challenge to liberal thinking when Bill Buckley wrote his book, God and Man at Yale. He was more in favor of God and man and was suspicious of Yale at the time, as most of you will remember. And I must say that with varying degrees, events since that time have proved that he continues to be right. But in the 50s, men like Kirk and Weaver and Hayek and Chambers and von Mises and Buckley established conservative intellectual credentials and wrote the seminal works of the mind which explicated our principles. During this time, Glenn Campbell and others, particularly the Hoover Institution, stood as a continuing symbol for the preservation and expansion of conservative thought. And then it was in the 60s that conservatives began to actively proselytize those principles and to provide a stimulus to counter the fact that the left had out-organized us, particularly on the campuses. And new organizations and new strains of thought began. Organizations such as ISI, the Philadelphia Society, and other groups became active. And there was a start of some new ideas penetrating the academic, the intellectual, and the political scene. In the 70s, the conservatives began to address more adequately the particulars of public policy, and in the process began to develop a means of outmaneuvering the left, a phenomenon that even today, I suspect, would amaze some of us when we think of how much has occurred in the past 15 or 20 years. Joining the Hoover Institution were such groups as the Heritage Foundation, or for some of you old-timers, remember the Schuckman Foundation, which started in four or five rooms on the second floor of a building near Union Station. Now, as you know, virtually every month we go to the cornerstone leg of a new addition to the Heritage Foundation building, and there is some thought that the reason for building the Hart-Senate office building is that they plan to take over the Russell building. But seriously, the Heritage Foundation, Institute for Contemporary Studies, and we could go on naming them, have provided a very formidable force in opposing the ideas of the left and in providing some new ideas which have become now the foundation of much of our public policy. As a matter of fact, the Heritage Foundation's resource conferences, which they now hold, are attended by so many different organizations that they almost have to call a halt to those who are invited. And this has been mirrored throughout the conservative movement, as the intellectual revival of conservatism has preceded and through the 70s and into the 80s made possible the current muscular resurgence of conservative politics. Today, I think it's interesting to see what is happening in Washington, and many of us become discouraged. I know I do from time to time that we're not making enough progress. But I think as we look around, even our opponents are admitting, as did Tom Wicker of the New York Times, hardly a cheerleader for the conservative movement, or some of the other writers in the Washington Post, that there has been a significant shift in the debate as to the direction in which public policy should go. And as they say, the debate is not whether to increase the defense budget, but whether to increase it by 10% or 5% in real terms. It is not whether to reduce the increase in the rate of domestic spending, but where and how much to reduce that rate of increase. Particularly, it is my feeling, and I know President Reagan shares this, that the electoral victory of 1980 was the result of 30 years of selfless work by many of you and your colleagues. In fact, he stated this in March at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington when he says, "For whatever history does finally say about our cause, it must say that the conservative movement in the 20th century enabled America to hold fast through hard and difficult years to its vision of the truth. And history must also say that our victory, when it was achieved, was not so much a victory of politics as it was a victory of ideas. Not so much a victory for any one man or one party, as it was a victory for a set of principles, principles that were protected and nourished by a few unselfish Americans through many grim and heartbreaking defeats." Well, I would suggest to you that the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 was not the culmination of a movement, but rather a turning point, a new beginning, the opportunity on a national scale to translate ideas and objectives into programs and policies. Today, just a little over 2 years later, many of us are taking stock of the response to the challenge that was provided by the thinking of the 50s and 60s and 70s. And so it's in that spirit that this conference asks the question, reflected in your theme, do conservative ideas necessarily have conservative consequences? Well, I would suggest to you that the answer to that question is no. And the reason I say that is because of that word in there, necessarily. I don't think necessarily conservative ideas always have conservative consequences. Ideas do not mean consequences unless they're translated into action. And I would suggest that the type of consequences that result from ideas depends to a great extent to the care that is taken to be sure that the philosophy that lies behind ideas is not lost in the translation process. So I would suggest to you that conservative ideas can have conservative consequences if there exists simultaneously the means and the will to take the actions and make the decisions that are needed for translating those thoughts and ideas into solid achievements. Now I know that in the conservative movement, as people look at the scene today, there are some who are discouraged by some of the things that have happened and by some of the things that haven't happened. And I agree, because as I said, we all get discouraged sometimes by what hasn't been done. And I say that's good. I think in our movement, we want to be looking ahead as to what might be done and not be complacent or self-satisfied with what has been done. We have been, I believe, making progress in transforming a vision into a reality. But I would certainly hope that the vision of where we ought to be going must constantly stay ahead of what is achievable, or else we will be setting our sights too low, and we will be attaining only that which is easily grabbable or achievable, and will not be looking down the path farther at what might be done if we exert the effort and have the will. We don't want to set our sights too low. At the same time, I think it is important to view with appreciation the fact that conservatism in this age is more than just intellectually respectable. and that conservatism is the wellspring of virtually all the creative ideas that are presently being advanced in the field of public policy. There is nothing that attests more to the bankruptcy of the left than the mini convention staged last year by the Democrats, in which throughout some 48 hours of presentations of people and proposals, there was not one new idea that hadn't already been tried and failed or had been hopelessly rejected as unfit for this country. And that's why I say that today it is our ideas that are taking hold. While most Americans are not particularly ideological in their approach to politics, it's interesting to note that in public opinion polls, half of the people of the United States are willing to identify themselves as conservatives, while only one-fifth would classify themselves as liberals. The conservative trend in public opinion is evident in the results of polls on crime, big government, and other key national issues. And there is increasing concern in this nation with religion, family, community, and traditional moral values. The nihilism of the 60s, the narcissism of the 70s, has given way in the 80s, I would suggest, to a rediscovery of what Dr. Kirk has called the permanent things. And I might say that I'm just not quoting him to butter him up because he's the president of your organization. As a matter of fact, I wrote these things before I realized he was going to be your president. But isn't it amazing how that kind of good thinking just seems to reoccur as you study conservative doctrine? But I would suggest to you that we have one of the most conservative presidents in this century who now sits in the White House. And at this time, I know that some of the faithful are looking around at a still huge government and still high taxes and are beginning to wonder if conservative ideas as espoused by this group will ever have conservative consequences. In one very important sense, I don't think it can be denied that conservative ideas have made substantial conservative consequences under this administration, and I won't go into them now. I think you know what the achievements are, whether it be inflation, the reduction of personal tax rates, bringing under control the increase in the growth of government, and so on. The fact that there has been a considerable constraint on regulations and a reduction in the number of regulations imposed on our people and our businesses and our labor unions. That real defense spending is increasing, and that in foreign policy there is a hard-nosed realism about where we are and about what other countries are trying to do. These are real and significant accomplishments, and we could go into much detail about them. But on the other hand, some who have fought for years for these principles believe that change has not come fast enough or gone far enough. And as I say, this is something with which I certainly would agree. We have made progress, but we have to recognize there is much to be done. Well, what are the obstacles then to keep us from doing more? I would suggest to you that there are four things that we have to recognize as obstacles and be willing to overcome them. The first is what I would call the tyranny of events. No president, no matter how dedicated or capable, can operate outside the framework of political, economic, or international events. And so it is important that we recognize what obstacles may occur from these sources and take action to overcome them. For example, when Ronald Reagan took office, not even he realized, and I suspect most of us here did not realize, the enormity of the economic problems that had been inherited. And as a result, the country plunged into a recession. The high interest rates, which stayed there for so long, which were the result of the inflation that he inherited, produced a recession which had a market effect upon this country and which temporarily provided an obstacle to greater progress as far as conservative thinking was concerned. It had two immediate effects. First of all, it worsened the budget difficulties by depressing tax revenues and ballooning spending. And secondly, it made changes in any federal spending program much more difficult because of the perception that any cutback would hurt the poor and unemployed, who were so much in evidence because of the recession, and who were so much in evidence because of the propensity of the news media to find them wherever they might be. Fortunately, the policies that most of us would espouse have been carried out. The president's decisive action in his willingness to stay the course are producing the kind of a recovery that has now started. But in order to overcome this obstacle, this historical obstacle, I would suggest that rather than being faint-hearted, today is a time in which conservatives have to renew and redouble their efforts to bring to public attention the need for the kinds of principles that Ronald Reagan ran on in 1980 and which continue to unite this group here today. As the recovery occurs, we must refocus the attention of the public and the news media on the conservative agenda just as much as the attention was given to it in the early days of 1981. A second obstacle that I'd like to talk about is the difficulty of reducing conservative principles to the simple catchphrases that are too often the hallmark of modern liberalism. And this is why it takes a real effort on our part to bring the public into a recognition of the truth and the validity of the propositions that we set forth. The liberals always have an answer for every problem. It's usually to throw more money at it. It's usually involved with creating a new program. It usually involves government doing something more than it had been doing in the past. And this is very appealing to politicians, because politicians want to find something they can do to convince the people that they're helping them, even though the public quite often suffers more because of the efforts once they come to fruition. Take the matter of unemployment, for example. How much easier it is for the liberals to climb up on the podium and simply say jobs and then spend more federal funds than it is to say, as conservatives would, that the only way in which we're going to produce lasting jobs and a lasting recovery is to rely on economic growth in the private sector. But that's a tough problem to explain to the public, and it's something that can't be capsulized in 20 seconds on a TV program, and that's why this is a particular obstacle. And that's why it is important that the articulation of the basic themes that have predominated this conference continue in even more understandable ways to the public generally. And that leads to a third major obstacle, and that is the dominant role of the media. We need to have conservatives utilize the media to a much greater extent to combat the prevailing conventional myths and the prevailing conventional wisdom and the thought patterns and philosophical background that permeates most of the media today. We've long complained as conservatives that the media has a liberal bias. Recent studies, such as that was published in Public Opinion magazine, have confirmed this. As a matter of fact, the situation as revealed by those studies are far worse than most of us really thought. On issue after issue, members of the media are far more liberal than the American population as a whole. But that's why it is critical that conservatives take to television, the most popular media, and in the minds of the people, the most trustworthy, that we continue to use opportunities. That's why I'm pleased that we have the Washington Times in Washington, D.C. For one thing, it's the only way I get to read Jeff Hart's columns. But it is important that we do utilize all forms of media. Ed Folner's columns sent around the country to various newspapers. They may not be the largest metropolitan dailies, but they're getting through to the public. And that's why we have to take the extra effort in all the organizations that are represented here to do the op-ed pages pieces, to do the articles, which will start to continue on our side the steady drumbeat so that we can continue to let people understand, which basically they will. They have a gut reaction that we are right, but it has to be articulated even in times of stress such as economic difficulties so that they understand what lies behind the conservative approach to public policy. And the fourth and final obstacle that I want to talk about is inertia, public policy inertia, or the often blind resistance to change which is occasioned primarily by government. I could talk about the bureaucracy, but you know that backwards and forwards. You understand the problems of bureaucratic inertia. I'd like to talk about other types of inertia, and one of them is political inertia. We have in Washington, D.C. now, for the first time in a quarter of a century, a Senate that is controlled by Republicans. And yet, the ideas of political inertia are never found more apparently than what's occurred in the last 2 weeks as that Republican Senate looks at the budget. There has been too often the response of government, and that is to spend more money to continue the spending programs. And that's why it is so critical that these men, encouraged, and women, encouraged by people such as yourselves. Step back and look at what they're doing and look at where they're going so that we don't have business as usual in the Senate Budget Committee or in any part of Congress. It's important that governors and mayors are elected so that they take a new look at what's going on. And we have some in this country that have been elected with conservative principles, but they are by no means a majority of the National Governors Conference or the National Association of Mayors. And so it is time that every effort be exerted upon these political leaders to let them know how important it is that they change and overcome this political inertia. And of course, I hardly have to talk about the courts, because this certainly is one of the major obstacles and another group that is particularly vulnerable to political inertia. The firestorm of judicial activism has not yet burned itself out. The courts are still too much involved in determining public policy rather than in interpreting it. And as a matter of fact, we may be in one of the most difficult periods that we've had for a long time, because when President Reagan took office, he found that his predecessor had left him with a federal bench tilted ever more heavily towards liberal policies because of the creation of the judgeships that had been denied to President Nixon and denied to President Ford, and which the judgeships which were created during the time of Jimmy Carter, so that today fully 42% of all sitting federal judges were appointed during the 4 years that Carter was in office. It is therefore legitimate to say, I think, when we view this political inertia, to say that while conservatives are in power in Washington, we have not yet reached that point when we can say that conservatives are totally in control. Now, there are some who would react to this situation by saying, well, conservatives just have to have more patience. I don't believe that that's true. I think we've had lots of patience. The time for patience in putting our policies into practice has long since ended. It's a time for action, it's a time for unity, and it's a time for progress. To make this progress, we have to do several things. The first, of course, is to persist in the pursuit of what we believe is right. People like yourselves have done an excellent job of promoting conservative ideas in the past. Matter of fact, I personally feel that Ronald Reagan would not have won had it not been for the conservative intellectual ferment which you helped to build during the 1970s and which fed the 1980 elections. But we have to continue to feed the ferment just as vigorously as we have in the past. The wave of liberalism has not yet been overcome, and as we see, because of the recession, there is now an attempt by the special interest groups to try a counterattack, which they tried in 1982 and which they'll try with even more vehemence in 1984. And that's why we have to be just as persistent and not give up or think it can't be done, but rather to redouble our efforts in putting forth our ideas. The second thing, as I alluded to earlier, is improved communication. We have to do a better job of finding more ways to get our ideas articulated in an understandable pattern and in understandable phrases so that we can get them before the American people. And we cannot allow the other side to either set the agenda or to set the phraseology. We cannot afford to leave unchallenged such notions as the idea that supporting the nuclear freeze is more principled than supporting an adequate defense. Now, this is tough, because sometimes the opponents are tough. When we have to take on, for example, certain representatives of one of the largest church denominations on a moral issue, that's a tough job. But it's got to be done if we're not going to allow the opponents of conservative principles, and frankly, the opponents of what I think are the best interests of the country, to remain in control. The president is moving to the high ground. I think he has seized a high moral position, but it is critical that we espouse that and recognize it and never let it be forgotten, that the moral position of facing up to the Soviet Union, of doing what's right in regard to Asia, in maintaining an adequate defense and a credible deterrent, to helping governments in Central America to preserve their ability to protect their people against terrorists, that these are moral positions. And this has to be pounded again and again before the American people so that it isn't just left to the other side. We also have to remain committed to conservative principles. We have to be willing, of course, to compromise in the sense of getting half a loaf now and the other half later. But we have to remain committed, and even though we can only progress so far at any one time, We have to continue to be committed and to indicate that commitment so that our own followers will not be faint of heart. And finally, it is absolutely essential that we work to elect more conservatives to office. It's awfully easy to retire to the academic community, to limit our activities to writing, to expressing thoughts, but it also means that we have to commit ourselves to political activity and to stimulating grassroots political activity among all those with whom we come in contact. We need more conservatives in the Congress if we are going to go forward with the principles and policies that the President is trying to proclaim. And that involves political activity along with intellectual and academic activity. Well, these are some of the thoughts that I would like to share with you, not as an ambassador from Washington, but as one of you who is temporarily located in that city. I feel that the prospect before us is wide open. If we rededicate our efforts, if we refocus public attention on the conservative agenda, if we continue to build on what we have thus far achieved, then I feel that we do have a chance of proving to the American people that there will be conservative ideas that can be turned into conservative consequences in the future. Thank you.
We have time for about 5 minutes of Q&A, if there are those of you who would like to ask. Dick?
I'll repeat the question. Would I comment on the concern that is felt by many that while the President continues to proclaim the policies, the problem lies in the implementation of the policies, and particularly the fact that some or many appointees appear to be co-opted by the bureaucracy. I think that's a continuing problem. It's always a problem in government, and it's a particular problem that we are addressing. I would say that probably this administration has done more to address the problem, to try to build a team and to preserve a sense of teamwork among our appointees through a variety of communications methods, management seminars, and other things to keep the group feeling a part of Ronald Reagan's team in Washington rather than simply a part of the whole bureaucratic machinery. But there are a lot of breakdowns. I agree with you. I think, on the other hand, there have also been a lot of successes. And sometimes we hear more about the breakdowns than we do of the successes. But I, frankly, am very much impressed with the fact that most of our appointees have not been co-opted. Some have, to be sure. Some of those we're trying to replace or move around or rebuild the fire that they came in with. But this is a perennial problem. It's part of the bureaucratic inertia that I didn't speak much about. But it's something that needs to be addressed. But I can only assure you this, we're very cognizant of the problem. We think that that the achievements far, that the changes that have been made in having an impact on the bureaucracy are far greater than most people realize, but we're very aware of this and working very hard on it. Yes. We expect the President to see one of the, I assume you're talking about one of the Adam Smith ties. Ed Fulner says one of the heritage ties. Well, I can't tell you for sure. It's not for any lack of commitment to the cause, but I think perhaps he's a little bit concerned, because we have kidded about this. He's concerned that if he wears one tie representing a particular symbol, that he may be deluged with requests for other ties. So he's assigned me the job of wearing the Adam Smith ties. The chairman of the Advisory Committee on Public Diplomacy regularly wears a heritage tie. And so, in true good executive fashion, he's delegated at least some of the work. Emphasis and change in strategy to active defense as espoused by the President in his speech recently in terms of a strategic ballistic missile defense. What are the chances of us following the Russians into a greater emphasis on civil defense and going public protection, going beyond merely the crisis relocation program? One of the things that we have done is to indicate that civil defense is one of our strategic priorities, along with the MX missile, the B-1 bomber, and the various other aspects of our total strategic posture. And we have increased both the emphasis, the organizational resources, and the funding for civil defense. It's by no means anywhere close to what the Soviet Union has done and is doing, but we think it is a small step in the right direction. We are looking to see how that does jibe with the new concepts that are coming up for strategic missile defense. But I must say that there are some tremendous obstacles to this. Try as we have, even though we have advocated larger amounts of money for civil defense, the Congress has not yet seen fit to give us anywhere near what we've asked for, and it's a continuing struggle. But this definitely is one of our priorities. It's one of the priorities that the President announced on the 18th or the 1st of October of 1981 when he gave his concept of where we're going in strategic arms. Did everybody hear the question? All right. What can be done is for us to work through the departments where the money is coming from to cut off those funds, but it is a long and laborious process, but I assure you we are working on it, and I would hope and I would ask, as a matter of fact, that you or anyone else that has organizations give the specific names of the organizations to us. If you'll give them to Ken Cribb here in the course of this meeting, I guarantee that every one of those will be looked at because we really are trying to do this. Now, we tried to do it in blanket fashion, as you know, recently with the circular from the Office of Management and Budget and got more flack from our friends than we did from our opponents, perhaps because it was done less than artfully. But in any event, that is a very big priority with us, and I'd like to know about those organizations because we will do that. We have some particular techniques that we are developing at the present time to identify and go after the funding if the funds are being used in a manner that's inappropriate for taxpayers' funds to be used. I don't want to go into it in any more detail because otherwise we'll have groups taking us to court. But I think they would stand up, and I really think I really hope we'll get that kind of information so we can go after them specifically. Yes. Okay, with the numbers indicating that the recovery is going forward, what is the situation with the deficit and what are we doing to bring it down? The budget strategy that the President announced in January of this year would have brought the deficit down even under the cautious assumptions that were made as to economic recovery so that we could balance the budget by the end of this decade. We feel that we have a plan to provide declining deficit balances in each year until we do eradicate it completely. But this depends, quite frankly, on the willingness of the Congress to cooperate with us. This means cutting some programs that have been the pets even among Republicans. This is why we're going to need a lot of public pressures brought to bear, not only in this budget, but in each of the budgets in the future. I think that it is possible for the deficit and already the economic recovery, which is greater than was anticipated in those cautious estimates, would enable us to get into balance as early as 1988 if we can provide the will to the Congress to make the necessary cuts. We feel that that you can have a realistic defense budget, the necessary defense budget, and still bring the budget into balance and reduce the deficit. But that's what we're committed to. The real test will be in the next 2 years primarily, based upon what the Congress is willing to do. But the President has indicated that he is prepared to veto any bill that would raise taxes in the next 2 years that would deal with doing away with either the tax cut this July or indexing, and is prepared to wield the veto pen in order to keep that spending under control. But it's going to take a lot of effort. Yes.
Out in fighting against the repeal of the 10% income or the interest and dividend withholding. It seems to me that flies in the face of his entire philosophy that he fought for in California and that he ran on his presidency.
Well, the question is, why is the president out in front on retaining the withholding of dividends and interest? It's quite frankly because he was persuaded by the facts, as brought to him by the Treasury people, that there are, in fact, $18 to $20 billion of income each year from dividends and interest that are escaping taxation, which results in about $4 billion loss of revenue. And so his feeling was, rather than do as some congressman wanted to do, impose new taxes on those people already paying their taxes, that it was better to collect the taxes from those people who aren't paying. And that's the reason for a position which I was happy to see National Review joined in their latest edition. Thank you very much.
Those of you who wish to attend one of the dinners tonight, please sign up at the desk immediately after this session. And the next session, which will begin immediately just down the hall. Thank you very much.